Okay, Topo Maps Plus is one of the world's leading backcountry navigation apps, turning your phone into a fully functional GPS unit. Backroads Maps Books is proud to offer maps as an in-app purchase for Topo Maps. This makes it super easy to download mobile apps for offline use. This way you can get accurate and reliable GPS tracking and navigation well out of cell and data service. With Topo Maps Plus, you can view your location on the map, add waypoints, trace new routes, measure distance and elevation, change and share your tracks with your friends, once you're back in service. Never get lost with Backroads Maps. Make sure to use the promo code FOCUS too, guys. You're going to get 10% off. A little quick tip there. Okay, welcome to another episode of the Focus Hunting Podcast. The Focus Hunting Podcast is part of the Waypoint Outdoor Collective. For more information on Waypoint, head on over to waypointtv.com. Great episode here. I'm super stoked to get out to you guys. I'm joined by my good friend, Paul McCartney. I'm sure you guys are familiar with him by now. He's been on this show. This is his third time, and he's been on countless other podcasts, so great stuff. He's actually hosting his own podcast, which is part of Hunt to Eat, so make sure you guys head on over and check out the stuff they got going on over at Hunt to Eat, and also listen to Paul on his podcast. Great stuff. Not a lot to say here. This is a great conversation. We get into forest fires, bears. Paul talks about his trip moving across Canada, and we talk about just some hunter ethics and trophy hunting and all that good stuff. Hope you guys enjoy this conversation, because I really enjoyed having it with Paul.
How you doing, bud? Get into it. Good. Very good. In Whitehorse, it's not pitch black, but it's still quite dark right now. So, doing well. Yeah, how about you?
Good. Good, man. Busy. Busy summer.
Yeah, same here.
Yeah, lots going on. Forest fires are pretty crazy.
Yeah, did they affect you a lot?
Yeah, it was kind of funny because we were watching the forest fires, obviously, when they started here in British Columbia, and then you didn't pay a lot of attention to them because they were so far away. And then we had this one, the White Rock Lake fire, and man, it started burning in, I think, the end of June, or early July. Mm-hmm. And then by, the middle of August, it had moved all the way down and it was on the other side of the lake. Yeah. Pretty crazy.
So it came down like quite a bit of slope and elevation there then.
Yeah. It started over by Kamloops area, and then it went all the, that worked its way all the way down to us here. And Kamloops is a 2-hour drive, so
holy smokes. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was on a field course this summer. I was teaching a field course at UConn University. We paddled the Stewart River and then into the Yukon River and up into Dawson, and went through an active burn. Which was ended up being, it's a lot less dramatic than what people are picturing from BC. I mean, we could see smoke coming on the hillside and see little bits of flame here and there, and the whole hillside was scorched, but trees were all still, I mean, there were still all kinds of standing trees, but mm-hmm. You smell it from way off and you can hear trees popping, and I guess they see smoke kind of coming up from different areas and stuff. So, it was like, it was wild to go through it. It was pretty kind of cool to see it, but, it's hard to visualize, mm-hmm. what these things kind of look like. And then you kind of go through and realize, this isn't that one was not big and not dramatic. And just kind of what's going on in forests as they burn, and how dynamic and how it's just not as straightforward and as kind of you picture,
Yeah, no, definitely. There's something else. And I mean, they're all a little different too, right? I mean, like you look at that one that ripped through Linton there. Just wiped that town out. It's crazy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah,
I drove wild. Through there. Yeah, I drove through there in the middle of September, and it's something out of a horror movie.
Really,
Yeah, it's pretty eerie driving through there. Just
I bet.
You see just buildings burnt right to the ground, and then you just you're driving through and you see you know, half playgrounds that are half standing and bicycles that are sitting on the side of the road, scorched. And
It's like literally like the scenes you when you like post-apocalyptic horror movies. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So,
man.
Yeah. Hopefully down here, the province has a plan of what to do with these forest fires. But I don't know. I don't know the way to go. I know the people talk about they need more controlled burns and, you know, maybe selective logging rather than clear cut logging. And I don't know.
Yeah. It's one of like, I've done a little bit of, you know, work and research on, forest fire ecology and sort of the history of forest fire suppression policies and then, you know, ecosystems that are fire dependent. And it's like, I mean, it's so difficult to know what we do at this point in 2021 after, you know, decades and I mean, dozens of decades of mismanaging as the case as often is ecosystems that are fire dependent and mismanaging fire policy. It's just tough to, there's just been so much change to the ecological communities and forest communities in areas that are fire dependent. And then, like you say, logging practices and other land management practices that it's just like, it's so difficult to know if and how we can ever get back to a place where fires are, and fires are not devastating, you know, not to mention then the changing nature of the fires themselves is unpredictable because of things like temperature changes and, you know, moisture regime changes because of climate change and all that stuff. And it's going to be such a challenge in the future. Still.
Yeah. Definitely. And you think like in BC here alone, we had, this year in 2021, there's 8,700 square kilometers of land burnt.
That's unbelievable, man.
That's a lot
in 1 year,
1 year alone.
And the intensity of them is the other thing, right? That it's like, I think this is some of the things that we have a challenge kind of communicating around fires is that they're not the same. Fires are so dynamic. And so it's like if you set a piece of paper on fire on one corner, you know, you can be pretty sure how it's going to burn across the piece of paper. But then you go and like drop little bits of gasoline on that paper at different spots. That changes how it burns. Then you soak the whole thing in gasoline and see how the intensity of changes. And I think it's a crude analogy, but like how we're seeing with forest fires is that the intensity of them, the speed that they burn and just the way and the patterns they burn is changing so much and becoming so unpredictable.
Yeah. There's something else. And that's just it. I mean, you know, the land, like BC is such a diverse place and some areas, they just how they burn is completely different than how they burn in other areas. So
yeah, exactly.
And some, yeah, I mean, you go like here in Kelowna, I mean, you know, that we've seen temperatures this year of 48 degrees plus, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, I mean, you go a little bit further west and you're on the coast and all of a sudden it's, you know, snap of fingers and the topography changes and yeah, it's tricky.
Yeah.
So how was your move?
Move was good. Move was hectic, but it was great, man. When we moved to Labrador in 2017, it was in the winter. So it's multiple flights from Ontario to get there. It's at least three flights. And the last flight is on little sort of 17-seater Twin Otters. We sort of packed up in a hurry to move, and you don't take everything. You just can't possibly take everything with you. So a lot of stuff went into storage in Ontario. And then we were in Labrador for 4 years. And then we decided to drive to Whitehorse because we wanted to pick all of our stuff up. And you always think you have less than you do. I do. I always think, I don't own much. But there's like 15 boxes of books.
Yeah.
And then, so anyway, it was great. We had a 6x12 cargo trailer that we drove from Labrador down to St. John's, Newfoundland. And we were there for the winter, 2020, 2021 winter. And then we started out from there in May and drove to Ontario and very quickly realized we either needed to get rid of a lot of stuff or we needed a bigger trailer. So we got a bigger trailer, yeah, of course. So anyway, then swapped up to a 7x14 and then made the, it was something like almost, it was like 10,000 kilometers that we covered from start to door to door. You know, from the, we were at one point, we have a picture of standing at Cape Spear National Monument in Newfoundland, which is the farthest, the most eastern point of North America. And there's a sign, there's a, this cool kind of four-way road sign that points to all of the northern, south, most northern, southern, and western points in North America. And the most western point in Canada. And the most western point in Canada is Kluane National Park, which is where we are now, basically. So went fully from the most eastern point to the most western point in the country.
Yeah.
So it was cool. Great though. It went well.
How long did that drive take you? That's quite the journey.
Yeah, well, we took the, we, when we left Newfoundland, the whole, all the Atlantic provinces were really starting to get into a bad place with COVID outbreaks. So we had some marathon drives those days from Newfoundland to Ontario. Ontario and Quebec were kind of a mess as well. And it was just sort of pouring in coffees and Red Bulls and making the drive so we didn't have to stop anywhere. So we hit Ontario, took a bit of a breather to repack everything, pick up all of our stuff there. Then from Ontario to Whitehorse, it was about 10 days, which was like not a grueling. They weren't grueling drive days. We had the dog with us, right. So I wanted to get her out. So those weren't grueling days, but they were, it was long enough. I mean, so it took 10 days from Ontario to Whitehorse.
So did you guys go, what route did you take? Like, did you go down through the southern part of the Maritime provinces, or did you go up? Like, what was your route you took?
Yeah, so came through, I mean, we hit every province except PEI and sort of drove by the bridge to PEI. And Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, up through Quebec and across. And then if we had been going straight to Whitehorse, the route would have been different. We would not have gone through more southern Ontario, but because we were stopping in Peterborough, Ontario, went to there, and then it was up through North Bay and Sudbury across the northern end of the Great Lakes. And then, you know, blew through Manitoba and Saskatchewan, and then up through Edmonton.
Oh yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Gotcha. And then, went up through, came into BC and did, I'm forgetting the exact order of the main towns, but through, Fort St. John.
Yep.
Right. And up, through Muncho Lake and Liard River and all that. And took our time a little bit through that area, through Muncho Lake and a couple campgrounds there. We went to the Liard River Hot Springs, which is like, it's such a cool place.
Oh, yeah.
So took a couple shorter days there to be able to see. I'd never been to Northern BC. So that was my first time seeing wild sheep and wild bison. Coming up through Northern BC. So that was, I mean, I shouldn't say my first time seeing wild bison. We drove through Elk Island National Park and saw bison, and then had a lively conversation around what constitutes wild, free-ranging wildlife, right? But then, up through BC, and just the wildlife we saw there was, I mean, to see, like, I'm from Ontario, so to see sheep crossing signs on the highway was like, it was cool.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, that's one neat thing about BC. There's a lot of cool critters for sure. We have those on the other side of the lake there, Okanagan Lake. It's full of bighorns, and we get those.
It was super cool. We stopped at one spot, and they have a road sign that kind of has a map that goes through the different species of sheep and the different subspecies of sheep and where the lines are. You know, in some cases where the actual biological lines are for different subspecies, but then other times kind of what they're called differently and where, how they sort of delineate the subspecies. And so it was really neat to get to kind of dive into the different species of Finhorn sheep, and as you get up into the Yukon, the Dall sheep and Fannin and all the, and those different subspecies. And I'd done a little bit of reading on sheep over the years. Valerius Geis has a great book about studying sheep, But yeah,
I actually I bought that one.
Oh yeah.
I was supposed to have Larry's on the show, and it and we got our times mixed up, and it didn't work out. And then sadly, after 2 days after we were supposed to do that show, he had his first issue, his first health issue.
Oh man. Yeah. So
he was you know, and I wasn't aware of this at the time. And then I kind of reached out him a couple more times, and then he had gotten back to me. He actually texted me and he told me what happened.
Oh, nice.
I was in shock. And then we were supposed to line it up again. And then he started not feeling good again. And then that was the last I heard of him.
So, it was so sad. So that book that I'm probably the same one you're talking about, Mountain Sheep and Man in the Northern Wilds.
Yeah. I haven't got into it yet, but, I have a whole bunch of his books. I went online there and I found a whole bunch on eBay. So every one I found, I went and purchased, but I haven't.
Yeah, that was a big loss to the conservation and science and hunting and you know, science communication communities. That was definitely a ripple.
Yeah, so. It's sad. It's too bad. No, big part of wildlife in North America, that's for sure.
Yeah, and that particular book, I think, was... I really like that one. I mean, the stories you told about it's called Mountain Sheep and Man, but he also does a lot in that book around mountain goats as well. One of the things that I did not know about the book until I started reading it was that book was really kind of his personal experiment into a different form of science communication. I mean, he was a brilliant academic and scientist and conservationist, but it had spoken a lot to the academic communities. In that book, he talks about, it was sort of he was sort of experimenting around communicating science to the popular community and to the public and the non-scientific public, and was kind of seeing, are people interested in this? Is it worthwhile and does it work and can I do it? And I mean, my answer would emphatically be yes, he can. Yeah. And yes, he could, and did it very well. But that part of thing to me, I think, but you know, when he wrote the book, it just shows that he was a visionary in a few different ways, because that's now one of the most critical parts to conservation and science informed conservation and engaging people in caring about the world is figuring out how to communicate well, and not just how to communicate well. And it's not enough just to be accurate and not enough just to be correct about the facts you say, but to be engaging and speak and kind of frame things well to the communities you're talking to. And that's something I think he just did so well. It was humor. The book's humorous and it's interesting and it's engaging and it's, you know, it's a good story too. So.
I first actually heard about Valerius Geist. A good friend of mine gave me his book on mule deer, and right away I just fell in love. That's, you know, inevitably led me down the path to this infatuation with mule deer. Just the way he puts everything together. And it's, like you said, it's from his own personal experiences. It's not, you know, he was out there, which amazed me is, you know, he was the guy that was out there spending time with the mule deer throughout the entire year. He was out in the bush and, just amazing, man. Yeah. It's
totally. And that's, I love that. I mean, I was just double checking here. I don't know what year the mule deer one was, but this sheep one was 1975. Yeah. So, I mean, the book is like, he talks about going out and building his cabin to live out there and study. And so this is still the era of, I mean, no one's using, you know, drones and,
That's really, what I mean. He was engaged himself, and you know what I mean? This is not something that, you know, he did a bit of research on and then, you know, he took it bits and pieces from other people. This is all personal experiences. And this is stuff that he actually witnessed and encountered in the wilderness. And I mean, you know, BC is not a forgiving place in the middle of September, never mind the middle of January. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. So this is mule deer country when you're talking about. Okay. So I need to read that one as well.
It's great. It's great.
But it does make you, sort of nostalgic for that, that time of naturalism and wildlife. The study of wildlife is just, you know, descriptions, and people, they're out there just making drawings and describing what they see. And it was an important time.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely, man. It's he's going to be missed, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So this is your first time up in the, have you been to UConn before you moved there?
Yeah, we took a couple trips here for work. So I was up, some friends of ours were out, who lived in Labrador when we were there, all had moved to Whitehorse. And so I was in Juneau, Alaska a number of years ago for a work trip. And then I sort of took a jaunt over, and Christine, my partner, came to Whitehorse. We took a bit of a vacation to see the place and visit our friends, and loved it right then. Went to Kluani and did some, you know, did some cool stuff. And sort of said at that time, well, if and when we leave Labrador, this will be a strong contender. And then I was back for another work trip a year later. And it was one of those, you know, let's see if it still holds up to the romantic memory of the place from the trip. And it did. We still loved it still. So yeah. I'd been twice and knew that it was a place, and had a lot of friends who were here. It's funny, for the size of the place, we have probably more friends, people we know in Whitehorse than any other city in Canada.
Oh, really?
It's, which is like, it's sort of a funny thing how certain places attract certain people.
Yeah.
We knew we were going to like it, and we do. And there's just so much to do here. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. That's one thing. I mean, don't get me wrong. I live in Southwest or Southeastern BC. There's lots of stuff to do, but living up north there, especially on the coast, it's you just miss the ocean and just the endless supply of wildlife and scenery.
We do miss the ocean. That's something that we've talked about. We both grew up in Ontario, so moving to the ocean in Labrador, I mean, we could see minke whales from our kitchen window. Being there, we absolutely became attached to the ocean. It was a completely different way of thinking about weather and about travel and what you do outside. And so moving away from the ocean, we definitely miss that. Being in mountains, you know, bigger mountains is amazing. And the wildlife here is, it's just unreal. Like the number of species that are walking around here. We do miss the ocean. It's also nice to be in rivers, and this is something that was different too, is sort of a place that is, and I imagine BC is similar to this as well in some cases, a place and a landscape that's in a lot of ways structured and defined by the movements of rivers.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than the ocean, right? Yeah. So it's sort of instead of this movement right to the coast, here it's river water, it's massive. Yeah. River watersheds, and the Yukon River is just, it's such a huge river. Going from BC to the Alaskan coast. I don't know if it starts in right in BC, but at least connects watersheds in from BC and Yukon right to the coast, right? So yeah. So there's sort of a different way to structure your thinking around how the landscape is kind of organized, and what is this the sort of organizing principle of the landscape, and it being rivers instead of ocean.
Yeah, exactly. But cool, man. So how does it work up there? Are you allowed to hunt up there this year?
Can hunt small game. So you got to be a resident here for a year.
Okay.
Which is agonizing right now because we're here right for the all through the year, the peak of it. But I gather they do so that people can't just come and say, ah, I'm a resident and hunt, you know, get access to all the hunting. But we can hunt small game this year. So we've got spruce grouse and ptarmigan. There's ground squirrels, and I'm trying to get into ground squirrels. I love squirrel hunting. So Arctic ground squirrel is a brand new species. And I'm trying to get into that and see what they taste like. But, and then in next year, so a year from when we got here, then mm-hmm. we can get into all the big game, you know, and that's like over the counter licenses or,
yeah, that's what my next question was going to be. What's available over the counter?
Yeah, so over the counter, you can get sheep, goat, caribou, moose, and bison.
Nice.
Now, some of those, there are draw units for.
Yeah, definitely.
But there are a lot over the counter, and those are, and then there's draw, there are draws for elk and mule deer.
Right.
And those are, I gather, exceptionally difficult to get. There are not many given out.
No, I don't imagine there's a huge population of elk up there.
Well,
I could be wrong. I don't.
It's sort of interesting. Like, there's a decent population of elk in one area. So I saw more elk this summer than any other species. Right.
Wow.
I mean, and by like massive amounts. So there is elk, but there's not a huge population, and they were reintroduced, and this is another one that is always an interesting discussion, is where the line is between introduction and reintroduction. So, you know, elk were here in northern Yukon right to the end of the Pleistocene, but were extirpated about 1500 years ago. So they were reintroduced in 1950 for hunting opportunities. Yeah. So, I mean, to me, I would absolutely consider that a reintroduction. But there're just not many licenses given out. So, but they're in one area here. I was doing a angler harvest survey this summer, Twin Lakes in Yukon, which is just north of Whitehorse. And driving back in the evening, I'd be there till 10 p.m. and then drive back. And in the peak of the summer, when it was light all night, you'd see a couple. As soon as it started hitting that dusk time, there'd be on one drive, I'd be seeing 14 and 15 and 16 elk on the side of the road. And that's like what you see, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. So it's, So there's definitely a decent population concentrated in an area, that was amazing for me. I hadn't seen, the only time I saw elk before was when I was here on vacation a few years ago. So I saw, and I got to see them throughout the season. So you'd see the bulls on the side of the road, and then saw a one drive, full velvet bull. And then the next drive, we got to see one with the velvet draping off of its antlers and everything. Yeah. So that was great. It was really cool to see all of them.
Yeah, no doubt. What was it like with all day daylight, I guess?
That was great. I mean, we had a bit of that in Maine, Labrador. It wasn't quite full daylight like here. So that was about 56 degrees latitude. So a little bit lower than here, but it would be certainly, it would get real, that kind of glowy blue for an hour or for a couple hours between 12:30 or 1 o'clock in the morning and 2 o'clock or 2:30 to 2-3 o'clock. So we're kind of familiar with it, but here, I mean, you could read a book outside all night long. It was really cool. Crazy. I mean, it was definitely interesting. And now we're getting into
the opposite side.
It's 9 o'clock right now and the sun is not up yet. So
yeah, I guess it is. You got to take one with the other.
Them both. Yeah.
That's one thing I hate about the wintertime, is just the lack of daylight hours.
Yeah, I do too. Especially in the evening, I don't mind if it's dark in the morning, but in the evening, I don't like having it dark.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I'd prefer it be light later. If it's 8 o'clock when it gets light, that's fine. As long as you get it's gonna be the same amount of daylight in a day, no matter what, right? Mm-hmm. But that's what drives me nuts about daylight savings time. We switch it back, and then we lose, an hour of daylight in the evening, which.
Well, and that's bonkers. And I wanted to stay on. So like daylight savings ends in November.
Yeah.
And so it was like, especially during hunting season in Ontario, the end of the clocks always went back. So you went back to like standard time, the weekend that deer season started.
Yeah. Sorry. I like daylight. Like I like,
no, totally.
Daylight savings. I don't like the,
which is sort of a funny thing.
I like it light later in the day.
Exactly. It's sort of a funny thing because it's like daylight savings. Well, why would I ever want to go off a thing called daylight savings then?
Yeah.
Like, so, and that was always the thing. And you know, you're like, oh, great. I have to get up an hour earlier now to go out deer hunting. But here they don't, you're going to be an hour, I guess, an hour behind from me, you know, in a few days, and everyone else will catch up a bit. But, I know I was happy that, well, I guess it's always 6 to 1, half dozen the other a little bit, because if you don't change, then it's which time are you really on? But
yeah,
I'm excited to not have to change time zones or change times anymore.
Yeah, I feel like we should be over with the whole daylight savings time. I don't know.
Yeah, and some provinces are thinking about it, I guess.
Yeah,
Ontario,
I know BC was talking about it, but they needed some of the states to some of the southern provinces or states below us to get on board. And,
oh, is that right?
Yeah, that's one article I read. That's what they were talking about. But
okay, I didn't realize
Washington
that.
Washington and California weren't, and Oregon weren't into it. So BC was, I don't know. Who knows?
Yeah. Okay.
We're not doing it. We're switching.
November 7th. Yeah. You've seen that great meme that's like, you know, people who think you cut an inch of your blanket off the bottom and sew it on the top, think you've got a longer blanket.
Yeah, I know. You still get like, yeah, we're not getting any more daylight. We're not losing.
No, no.
Yeah, I know. It's too funny. Too funny. So,
yeah. How's your season been going?
Good. Good. I was elk hunting in early season, and I had a 6-point, 6x6, smaller 6x6, had him at 50 yards during archery. He sat there. I had literally had 15 minutes or maybe longer to debate whether or not I should take this one or not. And this is on the second day. This is September 2nd, second day of opening archery, elk opening.
Okay.
And I let it walk. And then October 20th, I was out looking for one on October 20th, and I was kicking myself in the butt for letting that one pass on.
So how come you let that one pass? What was the like criteria for the decision?
Well, like in this one area where we're hunting, I've in the early parts of the summertime, I had a really big, really big 6x6 on one of my trail cameras, and it was in the same area. So I figured, you know, once the rut starts, this guy's going to be, he's going to take over, and he's going to be, you know, it'll be easy for me to track him down. But it just never happened.
Yeah.
For some reason or another, he didn't come back. So, yeah, I missed out. Like I said, a month and a half later, I was kicking myself for not taking
the
opportunity. But, and you know, the thing is, you know, you've obviously heard it, never pass on something that you're going to be looking for in the last day, right? And
I was going to say that too.
But I say that all the time too. You know what I mean? I always say that. I say that to other people, I say it to myself. And yeah, ate my own words this year
for
elk. But other than that, it was good. Got a nice mule deer.
Nice.
And then I had an LEH draw for bighorn. So I got a bighorn, which was
did?
Yeah.
Oh man, good for you.
Yeah, yeah. So I filled that LEH tag. I got it with my bow actually, which is pretty cool.
Holy smokes, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Now, so what was the deal there? Like, did you have to fly in somewhere for that?
No, it was up in Region 3, which is a little better. It's easy. It was easy to drive to, and I got a great buddy who gave me the inside scoop on him. So
nice. Okay, yeah. So you're like you started me out feeling like bad for you on the elk, got my sympathies up there, and then you came away from the season doing pretty well then.
Yeah, and it's still moose here opens November 1st, but it's a spike fork, so I mean that's
okay.
You know, that's a crapshoot, and whitetail deer start. Whitetail deer hunting starts September 1st, but I don't usually start hunting the whitetail deer till middle to the end of November, and then
that's when their rut probably kicks up.
Yeah, I find the end of November, early December, you really start to see some some of the bigger bucks, the activity of the whitetail just, you know, increases. So
yeah. I that was what I started hunting was whitetail. Well, I started with turkey, wild turkey.
I got a turkey this fall too, which was
Nice.
Kind of a relief. It's funny. I was out with a friend and he's a new hunter. So I took him out and we didn't have a shotgun or we didn't even have a 22. We had my bow and his 30-06.
Okay.
So, and I was driving around. I mean, I was hunting turkey this spring. And I was ready to give up hunt turkeys altogether. I was just like, I didn't have a good spring turkey hunt, right? You know how it is. So we're walking down this old service road, and a flock, you know, a big flock of turkeys walks out right in front of us. And I was like, oh, hey, we got some turkeys here. And I'm sitting around. I was like, I had my bow in my hand, and I'm sitting there like, man, I wish I had a shotgun. And I was like, wait a sec, I got my bow in my hand.
Yeah,
bonehead. So yeah, I ended up sneaking down on him and got within, I think it was 40 yards, and I got one. So came home.
That's
it was
impressive.
Funny because it was the day before Thanksgiving. So
nice.
I came home. I came back to we were staying down at my folks' place, and so I came home with the turkey this year, which was
turkey for cool. Thanksgiving. Nice.
Yeah. So we had.
I love those birds.
Yeah, yeah. It was kind of cool because we cook them up on a spit over a fire, and we had the wild one and the store-bought one that we already had. So
right on. That's great.
Yeah, yeah. And my buddy, unfortunately, we didn't get a deer for him, but he had a blast anyway.
That's awesome. That's great. I miss turkey hunting for sure. That's something that I'll do. That's something that I will have be very excited to come down to BC for us to get back into turkey
hunting.
Come
down. It's probably a day drive. Yeah, good day drive where you can break it up. You could go to Prince George.
Mm-hmm.
And then from Prince George down to Kelowna, and then we just go east from here. So anytime.
Yeah, I know. I would like to do that in the spring. It's something that I miss a lot from Ontario. That's what I started was turkey hunting in the spring.
Yeah.
And I love it. So I'll definitely do that. I'll definitely get down for that. It'll be good.
Yeah.
And it's nice just too. Such cool birds.
Yeah, they are. And spring bears open, and we have a lot of color phase bears down here.
Oh, nice. No, and that's the other one driving up through BC. I lost count of how many bears we saw.
Yeah,
that drive. But they became my favorite wild game over the last several years. So in Labrador, I mean, that was the only big game species that I could hunt myself, just an over the counter sort of license. So that was what we focused on, was bears, and got a couple bears from Labrador over the years, over the couple of years we're hunting there. And I've got on the wall behind me right now a picture of the bear, the last bear we shot, and the skull from the first one there. And it's become one of my favorite species to hunt, and probably my favorite wild game. And I know that people, that's a divisive statement, but
I love eating black bears, and I love them hunting them even more. I mean, they're mm-hmm. just such a, they're hard. They're a hard critter to hunt. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think a lot of people have this idea that black bears are, you know, you just drive down a road and you see a black bear and you shoot it, and it's easy. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not the case.
Well, I also like that because they're so wide ranging,
yeah,
you know, straight across the country, on the continent, but just for in a Canadian context, which means that you are not hunting them in the same terrain, in the same method across their range. And in a lot of cases, I think that's a bit different for other species. You know, wild turkey, the methods and the sort of, certainly the terrain, the landscape changes between BC and Ontario, of course, mm-hmm. but you get a bird that still responds to calling and still has, you know, you're sort of approaching it in similar ways. I hunted bear in Labrador from the ocean, driving, you know, trying to spot them from a boat in the ocean, and then getting up into thick brush or beach areas where they're eating mussels. I've hunted them in Ontario over bait because you're in a forest that you can't, that, you know, your line of sight is 30 yards because you've cleared trees.
Yeah.
And then I'm looking forward to hunting them here in the spring on sort of those exposed slopes where you can see them So I like spot and stock method.
Yeah,
exactly. And so I love that about bears. They really, for me, tie together in such a cool way. All these different one species that can tie together all these different methods and landscapes and habitats and stuff. So,
yeah.
And they're just such a, I agree with you. I love spending time with bears.
Yeah. They're fun to watch. I love watching them. I haven't been into bear hunting all that long. And this fall I was trying to get a bear, but I was trying to get it with my bow. So I got, I had a couple. If I would have had a rifle, I could have had them, but I just wanted that extra challenge, that little element of difficulty. So my goal was to get one with a bow, but I got till the end of November. So.
Oh, good. Yeah. Yeah. And bear meat. I think people have a sort of a mental challenge sometimes eating bear meat, but I have long maintained that anyone who I want to turn over to wild game, who I want to bring into wild game, it's bear. If they're good mentally, sort of emotionally eating it, it's bear meat that I will choose to serve them. My mom, when I was in Ontario on the drive here, left her a bunch of bear meat from Labrador and cooked her some. She cooked it for her before and she loved it. But so I left her a few chunks of it, and she's sent me two messages now saying she's cooked herself up some bear stew and a roast and stuff. And my mom does not hunt. She's never, gathered her own wild game.
Yeah.
And here she is cooking black bear meat on her own for friends. So
that's cool.
If someone says to me, I want to try wild game and I want to absolutely love it. Oh yeah. It's bear stew or slow cooked bear roast that I'm doing for them.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And that's one thing we've talked about this before is that, I need to work on my cooking skills of wild game. Cause if I make it, my wife eats it, but she has a hard time cooking it. I don't know what it is, but she just, it's funny. I got to do it if it's going to get done in our household. So I got to just work on that. For my birthday there, I got a good book on cooking wild game. So I'm going to have to put it to use this winter.
Oh, nice. Yeah. We both like to cook here, but we absolutely love experimenting with wild game. And I think one of the places we had to get to with it, because I'm not a chef and I would never claim to be the best cook. But when you get, just looking at two deer or two different bears, you don't know what you're getting in some cases.
Oh, absolutely.
The meat's going to taste so different. So we had to get to a place where it was like, I've cooked the best and the worst meals of my life using wild game.
Yeah.
Because sometimes I'll cook it and it's like, oh, I just missed the mark on that one. And because it's not that, like, you're not going to the grocery store and getting the exact same controlled cut of meat. And so sometimes it just is not good.
Well, exactly. And you can get a whitetail, for instance, you can get a whitetail in middle of September and it's going to taste a lot different. Like a buck you can get, that's going to taste a lot different than one you're going to get in the end of November.
Yep. And sometimes, we certainly are at a now where like we'll cook a thing of a meal of wild game, and not to sound real, cliched about it, but you enjoy it because it's a meal of wild game.
Yeah.
And so when it comes out a bit too tough or, the flavors aren't quite right, it's like, I'm still enjoying it.
Yeah.
Because it's a thing that we or friends of ours hunted and it's wild game. When it tastes perfect, you're on top of the world. But otherwise, we still just enjoy cooking with it and trying different things with it. And so that part of stuff to me is just as enjoyable. And so I don't mind even when I wouldn't serve it to someone because it's too tough or whatever the case is, you still really enjoy it.
Absolutely. And that's one thing that, my wife, and she's not the only one, she just gets so used to the bland, consistent taste that, store-bought chicken or beef has. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, it just all tastes the same. Like a chicken breast, obviously you can cook it a little different ways, but a chicken breast tastes like a chicken breast, which doesn't have a lot of taste to it, if you ask me, but
Yeah, yeah. You're never gonna Pepsi challenge someone on a chicken breast and have them ever guess where it came from.
Exactly. So
I'm looking forward to trying it, because that's the other thing is I've had bison and elk. You know, you go into like restaurants that have bison and elk burgers or sausages, but those aren't wild; they're farmed.
Yeah.
And so I've never had wild. I've had wild bison. I have had wild bison. I don't know that I've had wild elk now. And I, as a rule for myself, I typically just will not buy farmed wild game.
Right.
And here, right, they have elk farms. And you know, as a general rule, because I don't know enough about exactly how to evaluate wild game farms, in terms of their, ethics and ecological ethics. But one of the big problems with wild game farms is that they can be a common vector for disease transmission to wild populations. So as a general rule for myself, I just don't buy wild game that's been farmed.
And yeah, I know I've never had farmed elk.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder how much it tastes. It'd be cool to do a Pepsi challenge with that.
Well, that's what I'm, that's kind of what I'm, yeah, because now all people say like, oh, have you ever had elk? And I'm like, kinda. how do you consider?
Well, exactly. And I've eaten lots of wild elk, like elk that I've shot and elk that other people have shot, but I've never tried farm. So it's hard for me to say whether I've done it or not. Maybe somebody will let us know if there's a difference in taste.
Yeah, I am curious about that. And I was saying this recently, I guess.
One example is like on Thanksgiving there on the same fire pit, we had a wild turkey and a store-bought turkey, and they were cooked the exact same way with the same, you know what I mean, same seasoning on it, and they tasted completely different.
Oh yeah, exactly.
So that's a good question. You know, it'd be interesting to have.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's a super interesting comparison, because domestic turkeys, from my understanding, and again, I hope Stone will kindly correct me if I'm wrong here, but are typically as just a subspecies of a wild turkey. There's certainly some morphological and visual differences, but I, as far as I know, domestic turkeys are subspecies of I'm trying to remember the exact which species of wild turkey, but one of the wild turkey species. And so similarly with elk, I mean, farmed elk is an elk in terms of genetics. It's an elk. That's not the case when you get to beef, right? Farmed beef is a species. It's a difference. You're not going to, the wild ancestor of farmed, what we now have as farmed beef, is extinct.
Yeah.
So we don't have a direct comparison for farmed beef and wild beef in that sense, right? We do for elk and bison and to a debatable extent, turkeys. So it is an interesting comparison to take two. They're the same species and see if they taste the same. And even if they do taste the same, I still have, there's this ethical part of me that has a challenge with supporting game farms, knowing that a lot of our issues with things like chronic wasting disease.
Yeah.
And in some cases there's been concerns with disease transmission between sheep and goat, between farmed and wild populations.
Yeah. Well, that's the problem, you know, that the wild sheep society is facing is MOVI, and it's transferred from domestic sheep to wild sheep.
So, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And, so it's Eastern wild turkey, just to fill in my blank there, is the domestic or subspecies of Eastern, I believe. Yeah. And then, I mean, pigs are such a great example of that, because the domestic pig, Sus scrofa, is the same species as wild pig.
Yeah.
You release a domestic pig into the wild and it takes 5 minutes to become wild, because it's the same species. And I would suspect Again, I'm sure there are many people who have done this Pepsi challenge, but I would suspect that domestic pork is different from wild pigs.
Yeah, you'd think. I would think there would be.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's a good question. I'm thinking, you know, I've had bison. I can't remember if it was store-bought or if it was wild.
Well, here, I'll tell you what. Here's what we'll do then. We will, I will come there and we will hunt elk and wild turkey.
Yeah.
Because it's be very difficult for me to get an elk tag here. And then you come up here and we'll hunt bison. And we will do a big experiment with these, these things.
Sounds like a deal, man. I'd love to hunt bison.
I'd love to hunt. It's probably my top goal here. I mean, caribou, absolutely. Caribou is up there, but bison is just something that I've been so excited to get into. And that'll be likely most people hunt it in the winter. Most people do it on snowmobile in the winter. I would like to do it on foot. I'd like to try getting one on foot, you know, on a polk, on a sled or whatever.
Yeah.
And doing on skis or snowshoes.
That'd be cool.
Yeah.
What about brown bear up there? Is that LEH? How does that work?
You know, that's a good question. I mean, there are brown bears here. I haven't looked in a whole lot to,
because the brown bear hunt, it's, you can still hunt brown bears and Yukon.
Yep. Yeah, you can. And I just haven't looked in a lot to it. Have you hunted them ever?
No. Here it's
well, yeah, not now, I suppose, right?
Yeah, definitely not now. But here it's all LEH, or here it was LEH. I applied for it for numerous years, and I never got it. And then obviously in 2017 our unelected government kiboshed it. So
So here, I mean, it's $25 for a license for grizzly here from residents. And I don't think it's a draw. I know people who will get a grizzly tag when they go out, you know, caribou or moose hunting.
Yeah.
So that if something does happen with a grizzly and they do have to shoot it, then it's a hunt and not a, you know, you don't have to do kind of worry about it being
defense. Yeah,
exactly. So I don't know if there are units for grizzlies, certain draw units, but from what I understand, most of it is just over the counter. And I don't think it's super popular among residents. Certainly non-resident, the non-resident hunt is probably the big one for grizzly bears. Yeah. And then you're looking at, you know, hundreds and hundreds of dollars for them. I'll see. I'm not sure. Like, are you super interested in grizzly bear hunting?
If I went up there and hunted and I had the opportunity to buy a tag, I would definitely buy a tag. Like you say, you know what I mean? Like, if you're out in a hunt and you come across, you know, you come across one and you have an opportunity to harvest one, no doubt in my mind.
So I've been, it's something that I've been kind of questioning over the years, particularly as we knew we were moving here. I'm not sure if I'm interested in hunting a grizzly bear.
I would treat it the same way I treat a black bear.
Absolutely. And don't get me wrong, it's not, I'm not asking, are you interested in just shooting a brown bear? I fully agree. If I do, it'll be the same, with the same mentality and the same mindset as a deer or a black bear. But there's no doubt that for me, they are a different species in sort of in the imagination, my imagination. So I just haven't really ever sort of,
and that's weird,
decided if I am interested or not.
You know, that's weird. That, I mean, you and people and myself included, you just have this, I mean, you know, it's just a bear. It's just, you know, it's like we just, for some reason, we don't look at it the same way we look at a black bear.
No. And I'm,
do you know what I mean? Like
I totally know what you mean.
Doesn't deserve any more respect or, you know, than a black bear, but
no. Still. And that's the thing. I don't know what it is. I mean, I've been on a polar bear hunt. I wasn't hunting it myself. I was on a hunt with someone else and we shot one, and the hunter shot one, and I've eaten polar bear several times. It's one of those, I think, again, there's just not as many comparisons across species. So white-tailed deer is a white-tailed deer, you know, wild turkey, there are certainly different species, So maybe that one's different as well. But with bears, you have three different species, main species of bears in Canada. And so you have this like opportunity to compare, and they have so much different, the sort of portrayal of them in the media and popular culture and politics and everything is so different across those three species that I feel like I can't help but see them differently, because that's how we've been on a cultural and social cultural level. Yeah, they're very different.
That's how they've been portrayed as.
Totally. And I've worked on polar bear research. So I have a different relationship with polar bears than I do with black bears, where it's been purely a hunting situation. I have no relationship with grizzly bears because this is the first time I've ever lived in an area where they live. But I agree in terms of biology and meat consumption and hunting ethics and all that, I don't see them any different. I have no issue with people hunting grizzly bears because they're grizzly bears, where other people I think do. We treat grizzlies, and certainly their biology and ecology is different, and population dynamics, and especially you think about their sensitivity to things like habitat disturbance and things. There are big differences there between grizzlies and black bears, and so the management is different. But within you know, what we can presume to be in a lot of cases here, Yukon included, a system of well-regulated and well-managed hunting, I don't see them as different in that way. And so there's this, I do have this kind of question, internal question of, you know, why am I not driven to hunt grizzlies like I am black bears?
Maybe
I just need to do it. Maybe I just need to go try it and then kind of come to terms with whether or not it's different and why.
Yeah. A bear is a bear. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
And maybe what I'd like to do is go out with someone on their hunt.
Right. Yeah.
Someone I feel comfortable with and trust and can kind of dig into these conversations with and see, you know,
Then maybe
I'd be fired up to humble myself.
Yeah, no doubt. But like I said, if I get the opportunity, I would definitely have one in my pocket, because it's just something. Well, I mean, down here, you know, obviously we'll never get the grizzly bear hunt back. I don't think, anyway. I can't see, you know, once something's gone, I can't see them, you know, saying, unless, I mean, obviously, you know, we start getting a lot of it, you know, a lot of grizzly bears showing up in Stanley Park, like the coyotes did. I can't see it coming back.
Yeah. And I wonder how a future change in government will deal with that. Because like you say, it's just the social opinion
around it now.
It's already
gone. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know what I mean? And it's already gone. And I think politically, they wouldn't want that much scrutiny over giving it, you know, it's already gone. I think it'd be different if it was still on the table and say, you know, the government was, say the NDP government was considering it and, you know, say it was, you know, whatever it was, it hadn't been done yet, but, and then all of a sudden we switched to back to like a liberal government, then they'd be like, you know, just kind of sweep it under the rug. But now that it's gone, I just can't see it coming
back. Unless
there's, like I said, you know, unless all of a sudden, it's the same with the coyotes, right? Down in Vancouver. You know, I guarantee you a lot of the people changed their mind on coyote hunting once, you know, people started, joggers and stuff in Vancouver started getting nipped in the butt and stuff from those coyotes. So,
well, and maybe, you know, maybe the thing with bears too is, I don't know. I mean, it's so complicated talking about in dealing with and managing, politically speaking, managing bear hunts and grizzly bear hunts, especially, and polar bear hunts, especially. And I think collectively, I don't know, maybe, I don't know if we could have actually resisted grizzly bear hunting and bear hunting overall becoming so politicized. I don't know if we ran a human simulation 1,000 times, right? How many times would we get to a place where we are now with bears so political and representing such a polarizing and impassioned discussion around hunting between among society and between different kind of subcultures and perspectives in our communities and society? Probably many. Maybe it's one of those that just will continue to emerge because of a variety of historical issues, because of the how bears have been part of our kind of popular imagination and cultural discourse over the centuries. And because we have collectively in North America undergone concerted campaigns of extermination on bears. And so maybe this is just one of those situations where they are bound to be complex and difficult socially and culturally to talk about and manage. But I also think, you know, can we continue to move the conversation forward on hunting through bears and start to engage people? And I think we need to do it on both sides. I think the non-hunting, the part of the public, and I won't call them all non-hunters because there are a lot of members of the hunting community who opposed the grizzly bear hunt and supported the ban. So and this is what's fascinating about it to me, is that you have these sort of super permeable and shifting communities of people where you have hunters who don't like grizzly bear hunting and you have non-hunters who are okay with it and support grizzly bear hunting. So can we kind of continue to move the needle around and the conversation forward on hunting and management of species through the lens of grizzly bears? Even if we never, if the hunt never comes back, and even if we kind of, they kind of continue to be fairly polarizing and you know, instigate a lot of passion, it might be one that we just need to really kind of everyone to willing to buckle in and keep talking about and keep engaging with, because there's just something to learn about our interactions and hunting through bears.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why we love them so much, why we love hunting them so much.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I often wonder if the way that we manage here in BC specifically, if the way that we managed the grizzly bear hunt, if it would have, you know, had a different result. Because, you know, it used to say right in the regulations too, that you weren't required to remove the edible portions of a grizzly bear.
Yeah.
So, but like a black bear, you're required to, and the same with any other animal you harvest, you're required to remove all edible portions. Now, I wonder if things would have been differently if hunters, you know, would have put that onus on themselves of just saying, hey, this isn't right, we need to change this a little earlier. I wonder if that would have made a difference.
I couldn't agree more with the question there. And the same similar thing happened with mountain lions, right? With cougars.
Yeah.
I believe you didn't used to have to, and now you do.
Yeah,
I think so. And you look at what is another species that creates that kind of impassioned debate, and it's definitely cougar hunting. And I completely agree. I mean, one of the things that we cling to and pride ourselves as a you know, fair chase or ethical or thoughtful hunting community is that part of, well, we eat it. We're hunting for food. And, you know, and we kind of use all part, that kind of narrative that if we're being honest with ourselves, this sort of using all parts narrative has perhaps never been entirely accurate. Certainly it wasn't during the market hunting days. and up until very recently, you're right, like the legal requirement to take all edible parts was not there for all species.
No, exactly.
But I also then, I get myself into this question of, well, but if hunting is has always been, in terms of its the modern era of regulated hunting, has always been there as one management tool among many, right? We have habitat restoration projects, and we have closures and protected areas, and all sorts of different tools that managers and the public that we use to manage for healthy wildlife populations. And hunting is a tool in that. It's a tool for revenue generation. It's a tool for various aspects of population control, and not always just strict numbers, but also population control in the sense of sex ratios, right? And in that sense, you know, is it less ethical to hunt something as a engage in the man and the regulated use, the use of regulated hunting as a management tool? And you do your, you shoot an animal, and you've purchased your tags, you're contributing to the revenue stream needed. Is it inherently, objectively, less ethical to not eat all the animal?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't, yeah,
you know,
I mean, well, again, I've never, to be honest, I've never thought of it that way. I've, you know, that was just the way, you know, taking the meat out, hunting for meat. I mean, you know, it's tricky because I can't honestly, I wonder if I could honestly say, I mean, like, it doesn't matter what I shoot. I eat all the meat. I take all the meat out. Anything mm-hmm. I can, I take out. But I'm not a meat hunter. Do you know what I mean? Mm. Like I'll pass on a small buck and wait for a big one. I'll pass on a 6-point elk to wait for a bigger 6-point elk.
Okay. Yeah.
So, do you know what I mean? But it doesn't matter what I shoot. Everything comes home with me, it goes to my freezer and it gets eaten by me, or I give it to, you know, my employees love it when I give them meat. So, and they eat it. So it's not wasted.
But that's interesting, but you don't consider yourself a sort of hard categorized meat hunter.
No, exactly.
Yeah, interesting. Okay. I mean, I think I land in the same place as you, but from the reverse side, where I consider myself, and I think I'm getting the sense that you agree that these categories that we sort of superimpose are probably not, for most hunters, I think are not really reflective of how we do things. But for the sake of argument, I consider myself a meat hunter primarily. Mm-hmm. I don't really, I'll select by size or age to the best that I can. If someone says to me, you know, this area would benefit from younger deer being shot or does being shot. But at the same time, I've got what we would call, what some people would call trophies. I've got hides and I've got skulls and I've got antlers mounted. So do you know what I mean? I think you and I land in the exact same spot.
Yeah.
In terms of what we do with the animals we shoot and how we think about and approach hunting. So it's like, really, like, in a certain sense, does it matter then, right? Are these categories really that accurate and useful?
Yeah, well, exactly. And I mean, it's so, yeah, I mean, there's just so many facets of it. It's
mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'll clarify, like, I personally, for me, would feel less meaningful and ethical not eating the animals I shoot. I understand that there are cases, like there was a large sheep cull in the States recently this year, to manage a really sort of precise issue of sheep. And I understand that there are motivations for hunting and shooting animals not grounded in meat consumption. That's not to say those sheep weren't eaten, but just, you know what I mean? That the motivation for it was not primarily meat consumption. For me, so I support that. And I respect that is, like I say, it's a tool. Hunting is being used as a tool for management in a very specific case. For me personally, my answer to my own question would be, I do feel less ethical if I wasn't eating. I have no interest in hunting a grizzly and not eating the meat. And, you know, before those, mm-hmm. before the laws changed. So I would personally feel less ethical, less meaningful, less, you know, those things. But as a kind of philosophical question around the use of hunting and our purposes of it, it's challenging. And I think this is why I kind of get into this with bear hunting a lot, is that, like, it challenges what we think of as these really neat and tidy.
And and these are the things that bear hunting, you know what I mean? And whenever you talk about bear hunting or you get into bear hunting, it's kind of these questions, they just rise. And it's funny.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny how that one animal can bring out all these different nuanced conversations.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think I've been around a lot of them, around polar bears as well. A lot of northern communities, Inuit guides rely on what the regulations would call sport hunters for a major income, and mm-hmm. a lot of meat being brought into communities. And with the U.S. banning the you know, import of polar bear products, that changed the economies around.
Yeah,
the northern economies, and it's not that.
Yeah. So does that include? So well, I mean, that's another. Yeah, that's tricky too, right? I mean, that's a slippery slope for all of them, because if it turns out to be, you know, then it's going to be the brown bear that's not going to be allowed imported. And then, you know, like a moose, caribou, stone sheep, doll sheep. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It's one of those things. It's just slippery slope. Scary. If you start thinking about that, you know, well, like it's the same with, you know, the border being shut down to American residents, how, you know, what impact it had on the outfitter associate or the outfitters just from that, for that one year.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. These are the parts of the hunting world that, like I say, are not, they don't always fit these kind of comfortable, neat, tidy narratives.
No, they don't.
That enable the simplistic kind of pro anti hunting discussion. Yeah. And this is why I'm really big on, encouraging the hunting community, which is, you know, who I more speak to really resist this pro anti narrative and divide. I don't think it's really reflective of how the majority of the public thinks about hunting. Of course, there are folks out there who, no matter what, are pro hunting and no matter what, are anti hunting. But I think those are extremes that are not really the bulk of people. And I think as hunters, and I certainly say it to the non-hunting community as well, you know, let's not lock ourselves into that narrative, that binary, because there's way more going on.
Yeah.
To a lot of the hunting conversations, regulations, and then just, is it right or wrong? And is it, you know, are we pro or anti?
Yeah. And it's funny you mentioned that, because post our last conversation we had, I had a number of emails just regarding the vocabulary around the hunting. And we've kind of talked about this, and we won't dive into this right now, but just because it's going to lead to, you know, through three more hours of conversation here. But I mean, maybe that's something we can, we can talk about later on, and we can kind of get into that a little more. Is just, you know, this stereotypical, well, I shouldn't say stereotypical, but one guy wrote it in as this is the stereotypical vocabulary in the hunting world. And I think what he was kind of getting into was just the way it's perceived, or just the way the conversations, you know, how they've gone with podcasts and stuff is, you need, you know, to engage in these conversations, you need to be a scholar. You need to have a huge vocabulary to talk about this, which is completely not true.
So he felt that we were sort of guilty of that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's just, there was other specifics that he wrote in, talking about, you know, like on the Meat Eater, and, you know, your friend there, you were on his show, Ben O'Brien, and you know how they engage in conversations, and like yourself, they're all very smart, you know, very well-spoken, well-written individuals. And I think this one person, he kind of felt that, you know, he lacked that. And so he couldn't partake in these, you know, or engage in these conversations.
And that's super important. I mean, I'm absolutely willing to accept and plead a little bit guilty on that, because we opened this discussion about Valerius Geist and how brilliant he was at moving from within and between and the scientific discussions to the sort of popular communication. And to the extent that I am not good at that, I am more than humble to admit that. And so I take this guy's point absolutely. And to as much as if we alienate people with language and with you know, what can certainly be perceived as a sense of like superiority, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
That we're not bringing anyone in. And if others do that and alienate both the hunting and the non-hunting community, that's the worst. Then it's a complete failure. Because then who am I talking to, and what echo chamber am I just sitting in? Right. And pushing away the other hunters who just because we share a similar passion would already be willing. Hopefully we already share something in common. If I push them away, my God, there's, you know, something's wrong. Having said that, I also encourage the hunting community to give ourselves more credit. We are a smart group of people who do an activity that is extremely complex and necessary and thoughtful and meaningful. And I think my experience is that most hunters that I know are more than, we can engage in these conversations and we can get up to we can level up in our sort of sophistication or whatever, our critical thinking in those, right? So it's a hard line to walk though. And I, yeah. And I take, well, the guy's
it's
point
an interesting
for sure.
conversation, definitely.
Yeah.
Anyway, on that note, buddy, maybe we'll continue this conversation later on down the road. But you got something exciting going on. Why don't you tell everybody about your podcast?
Yeah, for sure. So I've been involved with Hunt to Eat for about a year and a half, and we recently just launched the Hunt to Eat show. So we've got launched it in early October. Got a couple episodes out now. It's going to be sort of a full sweep of discussions around hunting. We've got hunters, we've got biologists, we've got non-hunters. We have journalists come on, writers, and it's this, the idea that we're taking with it is to really focus on and organize it around Hunt to Eat's three pillars. So community, real food, and conservation, and to kind of have discussions and guests that hit on those things. And one of the big things that we're trying to do with it is think about how we can think about and learn about hunting in ways that might be totally off topic. So we have a poet on, and sort of how can we learn about hunting? How can we think about what we do as hunters? And draw inspiration from things that may or may not be at all related to hunting, but we have really great conversations. People have been super supportive. It's maybe not going to be for everyone, and that's what makes the hunting world great. So we actually would love to have you on as well.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Chat about some of the work you've done, and I know you've kind of exemplified a lot of the community aspect that Hunt to Eat really likes to celebrate.
I had Matt Ting on, and you know, he kind of alluded to there was something going on, but he didn't spill the beans, and he wasn't gonna spill the beans.
Yeah, well. No. So yeah. They launched the magazine, the new Hunt to Eat magazine, yeah. The Hunt to Eat show podcast. And there's gonna be a few other podcasts coming out as well.
Super cool.
So we're really trying to do a lot of kind of cross pollination with other like-minded people like you and like what you do with Focus. So
yeah, and that's cool. You know, that's the one cool thing about these podcasts is you can, I mean, they're yours, and the conversation can go, it can go any way, and it can go every way. So
yeah. And it's like, it's great. Some people will find an episode that they're just like, yeah, this is just not for me. and then all of a sudden we have someone on talking about preserving wild food and which, how to cook cuts of meat, and then all of a sudden that episode's for them, and that's I think that's fine. I think that's the way to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, again, it's, that's the coolest thing about these podcasts.
For sure.
Super cool. Okay, man, that's great. We'll talk about that soon, and I look forward to the hunts we got coming up. So yeah, take care.
Yeah, you too. Thanks a lot.